Mr. Toby Passman, thanks for coming on the podcast today. How are you doing?
Good, Shane. It's a pleasure to be on with you.
Yeah, thanks for coming. I'm excited for our conversation today. You're a neurophysiology researcher, and you've got your own podcast called Roscoe's Wetsuit Neuro Podcast, which is one of the coolest sounding names I've heard of. Certainly hard to forget that one, which is a really great show. I've listened to a bunch of it, and you do some fascinating interviews with people all about various aspects of neuroscience and neurophysiology and, you know, basically figuring out the workings of the brain and how it's able to be useful in clinical applications in terms of like neuromodulation techniques and emerging technologies and neurotropic drugs and all sorts of really cool and interesting things that are, it's an exciting time to be in this field, you know? How have you enjoyed that journey? I mean, what got you into it in the first place?
Yeah, well, and just, you know, thank you for the kind words regarding the podcast. As far as how I originally got into this whole space, I guess you could say, I mean, really, I like to say, you know, as a kid, I was always just a very curious person. I was always just like wondering why I am the way that I am, why I'm thinking the thoughts that I am, you know, how to influence those thoughts, you know, why other people are behaving the way they do. I was always just wondering. I think I had that capacity for like metacognition, like thinking about thinking, you know, from a very young age. And, you know, that curiosity led me to, in undergraduate, I was a business major at first, and I had absolutely no passion for business whatsoever, I quickly realized.
Yeah.
Those hour and 50 minute lectures were getting pretty brutal. And then I took a biopsychology class that really blew my mind, where we really focused on understanding the biological basis of how the brain functions on an electrical and chemical level. So that kind of, that class right there, sort of, I was so excited to go and so passionate about the material, it led me to start working at a research lab and then just kind of went on from there. But really, I think that that biopsychology class showed me that what I was interested in and passionate about could actually be developed into a field of study and then a career.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is totally fascinating when you get down into the details of, you know, how we're such, I mean, you know, we're entirely biological creatures, but we don't feel that way, right? And so it's very interesting to get into the nuts and bolts of how different, you know, brain structures and chemical compositions and how people are wired differently, so to speak, and how that all affects how people feel, how they think, how they behave, you know, all the various problems that come up with it as well. That's an also a different area. And then, you know, beyond that, the sort of clinical application of how do we make it better, or how do we help people who are suffering, or there's, you know, particular areas that can be improved. And, you know, that's a lot of the neuromodulation stuff that you're working with right now, right? So
exactly.
Actually, just so we give a bit of a good intro, could you give us a little brief on what neuromodulation is?
Absolutely. So let's first back up to talking about what how the brain actually works.
Sure.
So the brain runs on both electricity along with chemicals. So people are probably more familiar with the chemical side of things, with, you know, dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, these popular neurotransmitters that are really crucial for mood and memory and focus and all these important things. What's sometimes neglected in terms of at least the, you know, pop media side is the electrical activity of the brain. So we're able to record what's going on in the brain electrically with a technology called an electroencephalogram, or EEG for short. And that, for your listeners, you know, it kind of looks like if people have ever seen like a swim cap looking thing that has a bunch of electrodes on it, and it's basically measuring the electrical activity of the surface of the brain, what emanates up from the brain to the scalp. So with that technology, then that basically tells us what is going on in the brain, what It tells us about all of the different brain waves. Are they being produced in healthy quantities? Are they being underproduced? Are they being overproduced? And in which brain areas is that activity occurring in? So neuromodulation then comes in to say, okay, so the brain has this capacity for what's called neuroplasticity, its ability to change, reorganize itself. There's a component of neuroplasticity called neurogenesis, where the brain can actually grow new neurons, new brain cells, and new connections amongst those cells, which is super cool. So neuromodulation basically takes advantage of the fact that the brain is malleable, that we can train the brain and actually alter and improve the electrical activity of the brain with some different neurotechnologies I work with, such as neurofeedback or neurostimulation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense, right? And, you know, neuroplasticity is one of the most interesting aspects of it, where it's quite unlike anything else in your body that is able to do that. And it's also, if I'm not mistaken, continuous over a person's lifetime, right? Where at any point, your brain can adjust and create new neuro pathways and things like that to, you know, be different, I suppose, would be a way of characterizing it, especially if needed, right? Like after an accident or an illness or something like that, where parts of your brain stop working, you can then grow new pathways to pick up the slack that's missing.
Exactly. And that's something we didn't realize as far as like in neuroscience, they didn't realize that neuroplasticity took place over our full lifespan until a few decades ago. They used to think that, you know, as you know, our brains matured into adulthood, that they just kind of became, you know, fixed. And as we grew older or drank heavily, did drugs, you know, that we would just sort of start losing brain cells, you know, losing connections amongst those cells, which is true that brain cells do die off. But what's super cool is that new ones are constantly forming and new connections are forming. They have now established throughout our entire lifespan up until the day that we die. Neuroplasticity is still happening, which shocked a lot of researchers.
Right. Yeah. And I guess, you know, at one level that makes sense why the rest of the body seems to act in that sort of, you know, growth and then degenerative manner, where so you'd think that the whole body works like that. But at the same time, you know, no matter the rest of the state of your physical body, your brain or your conscious being, you're continually having new experiences and learning new things and having to integrate that into the rest of your system. And so it would make sense that these new pathways are constantly being formed, right? Because you're constantly growing mentally, let's say, or you're expanding your capacity for understanding or reasoning or things like that. And it is a fascinating field, and it's also a tremendously big medical benefits, right, for people who have struggled with various disorders or conditions, that, you know, you can actually make up a bunch of the lost area, right, in terms of being able to figure out how to retrain your brain. And so there's a lot of work at the moment that's going into figuring these things out, right, to help people. And that's one of the places where I think it, like medicine specifically, where the applications are greatly, I mean, there's huge potential for it and actuality as well, right? Like you're actually doing stuff with it these days.
Right. No, you bring up some great points as far as with medicine's application. I mean, that there's so many, you know, from psychiatry to neurology to, I mean, even in my opinion, I think like in the same way we go to our general health practitioner, you know, just for our yearly checkup, right? And they say, you know, get different recordings, they check our blood pressure, we go in and get, you know, labs drawn, and they're, you know, just checking to see how everything is doing. Like, what if, you know, say that EEG technology was brought into just a general doctor's office? It's not a difficult thing to be able to record an EEG. So if we just did that, say like every year, and just tracked people's electrical activity of their brain, and it's like, you could say, if you went into a checkup and was like, you know, you're like, doctor, you know, I've been having all these headaches and brain fog and all these weird symptoms, it's like they could then do another EEG test and see like, okay, well, what's changed from the previous one?
Right.
That's just one of my ideas. But yeah, like there's so many, there could be so many medical applications. I mean, there are. But then, yeah, what you were saying as far as what I do is definitely more so my business is focused in the peak performance or wellness space where, you know, the same people that go to your high-end yoga studios and shop for organic foods, go to cryotherapy, you know, people who really want to take care of their body and are willing to devote the time and resources to doing that. That's, I think, the sort of crowd that gravitates towards, you know, using this technology to enhance their cognitive performance, even if there isn't necessarily a, you know, a severe disorder or problem that they're coming to see me for.
Yeah, that makes sense too. I mean, you get people who are, you know, that passionate about physical fitness and nutrition, as you were saying, and, you know, take it to the highest level that they can, right? They're always trying to optimize everything. And that's great. I mean, you know, it provides a totally different existence for people, like once you get into it. And it's interesting how interconnected all of it is, right? I mean, just thinking about how nutrition and the kind of fuel that you give your body will affect how your brain functions, right? And so I'm assuming, you know, all of this is kind of incorporated and you get to use these technologies like EEG or neurofeedback to kind of figure that out, right? And so my question is, like, when let's say we're looking at EEG scans right now, how much at this point in time, let's say, how much can you know about why things are the way they are, as opposed to just seeing like, okay, well, there's decreased function in this area or increased function in this area, and you know, you sort of can see that it's not quite balanced or where it should be. I mean, I'm not sure what the right terminology is, but you know what I mean. And so how much of it can you actually know just from looking at those scans, right?
So there are certain signatures that come up on the brain maps, the EEG tests. So say, for instance, someone who has had a traumatic brain injury, they'll often be producing a lot of what's called waking delta. Delta is the slowest of the brain waves that we talk about that's usually produced in, you know, for healthy adults, they're producing a lot of delta in deep restorative sleep. Now, for someone with a brain injury, we'd actually see kind of a lot of delta coming from that part of the brain while they're still awake, while they're having the test done. So indicating that that area has kind of been damaged. So there are certain signatures such as that where it, you know, can really be suggestive of what the problem is. But other times it's, you know, we never do just the brain map alone. It's whether I've been doing this in a clinical setting or a peak performance setting, it's still the same in the sense that we make sure to do a thorough sort of intake with either the patient or the client, depending on what, you know, who we're working with.
Sure.
But getting a full like health history, neurological history, you know, if they've had headaches or migraines, any, you know, past histories of traumatic brain injuries, like even falls when they're a kid, you know, if it was significant enough, it could still be sort of showing up in the brain map. But really, you know, it's taking like a really thorough history and assessment to see, you know, what exactly is this person, you know, what are they reporting as far as their symptoms or what they're wanting to enhance? And then pairing that with the electrical data and saying like, oh, okay, well, this person's reporting a lot of difficulty with, say, verbal fluency, which is often connected with an area of the left prefrontal cortex. And so say we see the brain map and we see, oh, yeah, there is slowed activity in that area. So that makes sense, correlating kind of the data with the person's symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
But just the data alone, you know, it's you're really playing a guessing game. That's not usually enough to be able to, you know, we say in the field that the EEG or the brain maps are not a diagnostic tool. They can aid in sort of helping us kind of get a picture of what might be the problem. But but just the brain map alone isn't enough to confirm a diagnosis.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So it's the brain map in the context of the person and the person's life, right? And all those things taken together into consideration, you can come out with a diagnosis or something thereabouts that can make sense of what you're seeing. And I suppose that's how medicine tends to operate anyway, right? You go into the doctor and you're like, oh, my stomach's sore. Doctors don't just go, okay, doesn't matter why your stomach's sore, here's your medication or whatever it is. They're like, okay, well, let's look at why it might be this way, right? Like, what are the causes that tend to produce these kind of symptomatology and, you know, so forth. And so it would make sense that it's pretty much the same sort of approach in your field, right? And so who are the main people that you work with? Do you mostly do peak performance stuff, or do you do like clinical, you know, healing things?
So I previously was working at a substance abuse and mental health treatment facility in South Florida, where we were utilizing all of this neurotechnology to treat people who were, you know, coming off of substances or alcohol, along with, you know, oftentimes, you know, comorbid mental health conditions that would, you know, that they were kind of, you know, self-medicating from. So I do have some experience with that line of work, but my main interest, I figured out, does lie in sort of the peak performance space. So that's why my company does, like, I'm not a clinical psychologist. I'm not a licensed psychologist, so I can't actually claim to treat psychiatric or neurological conditions, despite the fact that this technology has plenty of research that says that it can help with those conditions. But for me personally, it's more so, you know, just a sort of an issue of semantics where, you know, instead of we're treating your depression, I can't say that, you know, I could say we're working to improve your mood.
Right.
Instead of reducing anxiety, you know, we're kind of calming your nervous system. So it's slightly different, but I think overall it's just utilizing the technology for a different sort of audience. And
yeah, and just looking to help people, right?
Looking to help people, exactly. Yeah. And whether that be, you know, people who are really kind of at the end of the line, struggling with really serious drug addiction or, you know, mental health problems, but also the people who are just, you know, they're you know, busy professional. They've got, you know, a partner and a couple kids that they, you know, they're just constantly busy and their brain isn't, you know, performing in the way they want it to. That's something that, you know, using neuromodulation and implementing some other kind of just lifestyle habits can really boost their cognitive performance and allow them to do so much more in the world.
Right. So what exactly is the connection between how a person thinks they should be doing and what the reality of the situation is, if that makes sense? Like, how do you find that line? Because, you know, I think that, at least speaking for myself, like, a lot of times I think I should be able to do more than I actually can do, right? And so does that come up at all where people are like, I want to perform at the highest level, which is not really a realistic achievement or not one that would last very long, right? You would burn yourself out too quickly, like overtraining if something, you know, for some physical event or something like that. Does that come up as well?
Yeah, I would say so. So you're talking about people who overutilize like the technology, or you're more so like referring to people who are just wanting to really push the boundaries of what their brain can do?
Yeah, I guess it's a bit of both. It's not really like overutilizing it. It's more just like, how does one know what's an appropriate step up and what's pushing it too far? Or do you have to figure that out by doing?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, as far as like someone's self-awareness in terms of like how their brain is doing, you know, it definitely ranges. Right. You know, I'd say the peak performance crowd that I primarily work with now are usually much more self-aware than, you know, say the substance abuse crowd, who might not really have any awareness of, you know, how neuroscience or psychology or thinking about how their brain functions. Just, you know, an overgeneralization, but that tended to be the way it was. So it's definitely, you know, some people definitely are reporting that, you know, a lot of symptoms that they're just really struggling. And then say the brain map, we might actually see it looks pretty good. It actually looks like their brain is doing pretty well. There could be other people who are really unaware of maybe some of the deficits, or, you know, that their brain is not performing up to par. And then we do a brain map and we see, oh my gosh, there's really significant dysregulation. Like, this person could really be improved. Their life could really improve if we regulated these parts of their brain.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's definitely a variability as far as like people's self-awareness and how that matches up with how the brain map data actually looks.
Right. And yeah, that self-awareness aspect is very interesting, because it's not a clear cut, as you say, you know, it's not clear cut that it's like everyone has this level of self-awareness. And you can know you have I suppose most humans know that they're self-aware to some degree. They might not think about it very much, but, you know, if you ask them, you know, do you know that you're thinking or that you're alive, they would be able to say yes. Maybe not everyone, but certainly, you know, most people, I would guess, and that is a guess. But, you know, so do you know where does that self-awareness like manifest in the brain? Like, how does that show up in itself?
That's a good question. So the prefrontal cortex, the very front part of our brain, kind of right behind our forehead, is usually thought of as the very kind of human part of our brain that enables us to have that like metacognition, like thinking about our thinking and being self-aware. And that's an area that, like, you know, mindfulness practice will boost the activity, boost blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, you know, indicating that it's actually improving our ability to be self-aware and mindful of more things, you know, either in our internal or external environment. So I'd say, yeah, that's definitely probably the key brain area when it comes to self-awareness. And boosting activity in the prefrontal cortex, if low, I think is a great way to sort of gain self-awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you take the example of, say, you know, someone who's an alcoholic who uses, who gets drunk a lot, that's significantly lowering blood flow to the prefrontal cortex. And, you know, what are the characteristics of someone who's drunk? They, you know, they don't really have much awareness. They don't have any impulse control. They're saying whatever's on their mind, whatever first comes to them. They're not sort of regulating and thinking about their behaviors. Right. So on the contrary, you know, doing things that actually enhance our ability to be aware, such as, you know, I think mindfulness or meditation, yoga, you know, exercising, you know, journaling, any sort of practice that cultivates that, those networks in which self-awareness kind of is being grown from. Because I think it's a matter of like the use it or lose it principle, in the sense that if you are consistently working on, you know, developing that self-awareness, your brain starts sort of devoting more neural resources to that self-awareness, to that practice. So it's definitely something that can be trained and improved.
Right. And the evidence does seem to suggest that increased self-awareness is correlated with an increased sense of well-being, right?
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking.
Yes. Yeah. From my understanding of the studies, yes.
Which is also interesting in and of itself, right? That the more or the deeper you have this level of self-awareness, the more content or peaceful or well you'll feel, right? Which isn't exactly obvious why to me, because it would seem that like nothing if you just isolate it, it would be like, well, nothing else really is changing. You just know more about the workings of your own system and your place in the world, I suppose. And I guess if you know more about it, then the problems that you typically feel associated with it, of like, who am I and where's my place and what do I need to do, and all these kinds of like manifested anxieties or whatever you call them, if you go deep enough into it, you can kind of resolve by figuring it out. Does that kind of make sense to you as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I've thought about that a lot too, as far as like, I think self-awareness can be both a blessing and a curse, you know, in terms of, you could be very self-aware of a problem, and maybe you're even aware of why there's that problem in the first place, but it's still there and still, you know, a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, I think as far as how it can help, you know, basically, I mean, I think a lot of people still don't understand that, you know, your brain is basically generating any emotion, like in terms of, if someone has a conversation, they're having an interaction with another person, and that person says something that, say, triggers them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they think, oh, you know, my boss made me mad. My boss said that, and they made me mad. But that's not actually, like, there's a step in between where it's like our internal dialogue, our internal like representation of, like, that's the stimulus, the boss yelling at us. But then there's a piece of us that maybe that boss yelling at us, that triggers the loop of, oh, I'm not good enough. I'm never going to be able to, you know, retain this job, or, you know, just tons of bad stuff that we say about ourselves. But a lot of people, I don't think, realize that there's that in-between step between like the actual like stimulus and the response.
Right.
Like, so once you like cultivate that awareness that everything, every interaction that you're having with anyone or anything, it's like your mind is putting certain labels and filters on that that results in the emotions and feelings that you have about a situation or person.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Like that, you know, just when you're interacting with the world, right, your mind is, or your brain, whatever, is making sense of all of it, right? And that's kind of why, you know, two people can have the same experience from an objective perspective, but subjectively have had very different experiences, and why, like, one person will be triggered by their boss shouting at them, and another person will just shrug it off and be like, it is what it is, it's nothing to think about, or whatever. And then the other person, you know, as you say, will go into some sort of anxiety loop or a depressive state, or into like a depressive state. And in both cases, the stimulus is the same, but the response is totally different. And it's not that, you know, we're not saying that, like, people, it's your fault if you're doing these things. It's just like, it's good to know that that's how your brain works, because once you can know how it works, then you can start to do things to change it or to respond differently, or at least just to know that what's happening is at least one step closer to being able to do something constructive about it, right? So I guess that's why the self-awareness helps a lot in that capacity, right?
Totally.
So I have some questions, because you brought up that you worked with, you know, like substance abuse clients and things like that. So in that setting, right, there's often this phenomenon of like people knowing that they have a problem, but also not being able to do anything about it, or feeling like they don't have the control to be able to do anything about it. Now, do you think that ties into the prefrontal cortex activation as well, in the sense of like, with a diminished activity there, the ability for higher order control and thinking is impacted, and so it results in this sort of getting stuck in the loop?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, that's I would run neuropsych education groups with these patients, and that would be a common theme that we would focus on, is how, you know, the brain sort of is getting hijacked, that's the word that I would use, sort of by the amygdala, which is sort of the emotional sort of they're the limbic system, which is sort of our emotions and craving and reward network, you know, what gives us pleasure. And, you know, for people who are struggling like with substances, it's like that part of the brain kind of takes over. So even though there's certain things that that person should be doing, you know, to enhance their health or their family or their professional, you know, career, whatever it is, they're neglecting those responsibilities, you know, in favor of continuing to abuse whatever substance that they're using, you know, because it's giving them that immediate gratification, that pleasure that is going to be way more powerful coming from a drug than we could usually find, you know, in our mm-hmm. human experience, you could say. So I think it's definitely, you know, and then the other problem being that, you know, so you if someone's already kind of has a diminished activity in the prefrontal cortex, they're going to be more predisposed to likely utilizing drugs right. or alcohol. And that's actually was something that was originally sort of discovered with something they called the marshmallow test, which was like this psychology test where they had kids. They basically, the researcher would give a kid, you know, a marshmallow and say, you know, you can eat the marshmallow right now, or you can wait 30 minutes and then you get two marshmallows. So it's measuring, or, you know, these kids' ability to delay gratification, mm-hmm. basically measuring the strength of their prefrontal cortices. And they found that whether the kids, you know, ate that marshmallow right away or whether they were able to resist that initial temptation to get the two marshmallows, the better reward if they waited, that actually translated, like, they followed those kids and sort of follow-up, and they found that these kids, like, had the people who were able to delay gratification had, like, higher GPAs, better, they were making more money, more relationship success. Like, there were all these positive things associated with that, even into adulthood, whereas the kids who had troubles delaying the gratification often, you know, were had a much higher degree of substance abuse, school problems, like all sorts of more negative stuff related to an inability to control those sort of impulses. So I think it's absolutely critical to be able to, like, understand the fact that, you know, if you're struggling with an ability to sort of restrain yourself and you're, you know, kind of predisposed mm-hmm. or utilizing drugs and stuff, that's actually then going to even decrease the activity of the prefrontal cortex even further. So it becomes just kind of this downhill spiral.
Right.
And it can be really tricky to get someone out of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly very tricky. And that's why there's teams of experts everywhere trying to help people through it, you know, with, you know, a good deal of success and sometimes not. But, you know, there are lots of options for people, if anyone is in that situation. But I mean, so, you know, with the marshmallow experiment, it's a very interesting predictor, as you say, of what could come for this kid in their future, right? Now, is it possible to sort of see that in a, I don't know how old they were, 5, 7, whatever, and then use that? So let's say you had a kid that didn't delay the gratification. Is that something that you can sort of train or teach to kids? Or is it pretty set in stone based on your genetics or your biological makeup?
I think it's both, you know, as far as there definitely is a genetic component. You know, there's certain genes that make us more, you know, that sort of we are just naturally producing more or less dopamine, which often correlates to our, you know, whether we have sort of like an addictive personality per se. But, you know, absolutely, like, I think parents' role in just, you know, I think a kid can absolutely, you know, definitely be taught whether, you know, to delay gratification. And I think the more so they're taught that ability from an early age, I think that you know, I don't know, I'm not an expert in, you know, parenting by any means, but I would think that the more ways that a parent could figure out ways to teach their kids the value in being able to, you know, stick with something, you know, till completion, whether that be a homework assignment or a project that they're building, you know, despite the fact that there might be some, like, you know, quick fix, or, you know, might be better in the short time to just listen to music or play video games. Like, what's going to be really rewarding is to get that, like, actually contribute something and see something through from start to finish. So yeah, I think I think that can absolutely be trained, and even into adulthood. But I think it's definitely like as a child, their brains are so much more plastic still. So it's a lot easier to sort of wire and rewire our brains when we're younger. Right. Not to say that we can't still do that, you know, into adulthood, but just gets a bit tougher.
No, for sure. And it makes sense, because they're kind of, you know, growing to adapt to the world that they live in. And a large part of that comes from parental influence and societal influence of, excuse me, of how, you know, how to act and how to be, and, you know, what's good for you and what's not good for you. And I mean, it's a very interesting field. You know, I spoke to a woman on the podcast a few months ago, Dr. Hilary Marusak, who's also a neuroscience researcher, and she works with kids and studies the impact of meditation on kids who are going through cancer treatment or have gone through some sort of adverse childhood experience, to see how mindfulness or meditation can help with that, right? And she was saying that kids as young as like 3 and 5 could have been found to be really helped by it. Now, it's obviously different. I don't know the specifics of how they do this, because they obviously don't talk to the kids like adults, being like, oh, you know, you need to meditate for your self-awareness and things like that. It's more just like, hey, let's do this activity that the adults know cultivates that and the kids just enjoy doing, right? So martial arts was an example that she gave of being able to learn, you know, a discipline that helps in all other aspects, that's also fun. It's not just sitting still, like adults like to meditate, generally speaking, and kids tend to not. It's active, you know, it's good for the body as well, and it trains these, you know, good patterns across the board. So yeah, so it would make sense what you're saying about how you can figure it out with kids that are struggling or that have gone through trauma or, you know, cancer or something like that. And they found that it helps with their chemo and, you know, their outlook and across the board pretty much. And so it is really fascinating, and it would be a lifelong skill, assuming that it's sort of kept up, I suppose, right? It's use it or lose it kind of thing.
100%.
And so, you know, so when you were working with the substance abuse people, did you see what was the change in like the brain map from kind of, let's say, while using to a few months sober? What does that tend to look like?
Yeah, so we would initially see people and do brain maps on them when they first got into treatment, when they're still kind of in the detox phase. So they're often feeling pretty terrible. They're not too, usually most patients at that stage are not too pleasant to interact with. You know, they're really going through it. They're coming off, you know, whatever it was that they had been using, sometimes for you know, years. And yeah, so we would see tremendous dysregulation, kind of usually depending on what substance they'd been abusing. So for instance, like alcohol would often show up as we'd see like a lot of excessive beta brainwave activity and high beta activity. Beta is a brainwave that's really important for, you know, just our waking cognition and thinking about things and mental processing. It's kind of our waking state. So, you know, like you and I are producing mostly beta, or the listeners of the show right now are producing mostly beta, just paying attention to what we're saying. But in these, you know, often in sort of the alcoholic group, we would see way too much beta activity, because alcohol is going to suppress beta and really increase some of those slower brain waves while you're, you know, drinking, while you're intoxicated. But then kind of long term, it actually causes the brain to become very, very hyper aroused and needing that substance to kind of drop them back into a slower brainwave pattern.
Right.
But it, you know, it'll show up differently, say for, you know, say, that's a common pattern, I would say, but like, say like, you know, the stimulant crowd, people who are abusing stimulants, such as like methamphetamines, would often see actually, a real decrease in the production of the slower brainwaves.
Mm.
In the faster brainwaves rather, because they're using a substance that's kind of, you know, putting their brain into a very hyper aroused excitatory state. But then once they're off the substance, their brain kind of slows down quite a bit.
Right. Like a counterbalance. So,
a counterbalance. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Cause yeah, you know, drugs and alcohol do work in the short term. I mean, that's why they're so commonly used, is because they're very effective at immediately either stimulating the brain or slowing it down. But yeah, the brain does try to counterbalance that activity, exactly what you're saying. So that's why it's so, you know, important when we see the patient to do the brain map, so then we get an idea what's going on, which brain waves are dysregulated, in which areas of the brain this is occurring. And then once we actually start, we usually did neurostimulation. That was kind of the primary neuromodulation tool of choice. And it usually packs the most punch in the shortest amount of time. So neurofeedback can take a bit longer to be effective. Whereas with neurostimulation, you know, we're really using it with these people who are going through detox to aid their symptoms. So people would often report, you know, improved sleep, lessened anxiety. Those were kind of the two most common things I would hear from people.
Which is huge.
Which is huge.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just getting them through, you know, the roughest stage, often at the beginning.
Right.
But yeah, to answer like kind of the latter part of your question, what we would actually see once these people have kind of been stabilized for several weeks and they've been doing the neurostimulation, there's tremendous changes.
Right.
And people, that's actually kind of my favorite part, is showing people kind of the before and after brain maps, where you can see neuroplasticity directly in action. You know, it's not just me saying, you know, your brain can change, your brain can improve its activity. It's like, here you go. You see how dysregulated all of these areas were, you know, and then you see kind of with a follow-up recording how a person's brain is able to start improving.
Right.
And it might not be, you know, completely back to normal, but oftentimes like the severity of say the under or over activity would be greatly improved. So it's like someone's kind of getting on the right track.
Yeah. And in those kind of, you know, extreme cases, like that's where you would see the greatest level of like neuroplasticity, I would imagine, because you're not making minor adjustments, you know, for sort of the everyday folk. It's more like, you know, people in crisis in one state and then people in recovery in another state, and it's like completely different worlds, right? I mean, you don't even need a brain scan to know that about people. If you sort of are, you know, if you know anyone who's been through recovery, you can tell that they're like different people a lot of the time, in a good way, not in a bad way, right? But just, and it's mostly just how they feel about themselves more than anything, right? And so just a quick question. So this neurostimulation that you mentioned, how does that look? What is that treatment process?
Yeah, so neurostimulation, and oftentimes when I say neurostimulation, people's first sort of reaction to that is they're thinking, you know,
electroconvulsive
therapy, right? Like, well, you know, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest,
right?
They're getting, you know, we're shocking their brain. And what neurostimulation is now is not at all like that. It's using a much lower intensity electricity, a much lower intensity electrical current to stimulate the brain. Basically, what's going on is there's usually 2 to 6 electrodes that are placed along the scalp. at specific areas, wherever we're working, whichever sort of brain areas or networks that we're training. So that's all basically based off of what we see in the brain map. That'll give us an idea, you know, of what areas and what frequencies we need to entrain the brain. But then once we know that, so say someone like going back to the alcoholic sort of crowd, you know, where they often have all of this, you know, excessive beta wave production, and they're often deficient in, say, the slower brainwave frequencies such as alpha and theta. So with neurostimulation, we could directly, you know, stimulate alpha or theta brainwaves to actually relax their brains and, you know, actually induce a, you know, kind of a state of relaxation similar to what they might have with, you know, while they're drinking. I would actually notice, like, my experience doing neurostimulation, the protocol I really liked, I'd actually feel kind of in a way that, you know, I just had like a couple of drinks, like I just had kind of a buzz going on, feel good, was more like socially relaxed and stuff. So you can get that, but in a safe way. And then the brain starts learning how to actually produce those brain waves that you're entraining it to produce on its own.
Right.
So in the same way, like, you know, if you're teaching a kid to ride a bike, training wheels might be super helpful at, you know, just helping them kind of, you know, get a start and, you know, be able to get actually on the bike and get some progress. So that's kind of how neurostimulation is, where it's sort of guiding and entraining the brain, you know, after not being functional for so long and relying on, you know, substances to sort of modulate the brain activity. It's like a person's brain is capable of regulating itself, but often needs that sort of guidance as far as what to do, where to go.
Right.
So the neurostimulation over time, you know, you do a handful of sessions, the brain starts actually getting really good at producing those brain waves on its own without, you know, without actually having the stimulation like needing to continuously happen.
Right. And so how many sessions is typically a treatment program?
Oftentimes like 5 to 10 sessions is a good start. Wow. You know, we would see significant changes in a brain map after 5 to 10 sessions. But, you know, it's something like, you know, people always ask like, oh, have I done it enough? You know, and my sort of take on it is, you know, it's sort of like exercise in the sense that you could be super out of shape and you start hitting the gym and you get in good shape. I mean, if you want, like, you know, if your goal was to just like lose all of that weight and build some muscle, okay, you accomplish that, you know, and you might kind of stop going to the gym, you know, and that's great if that's you. But at the same time, there's people who are going to continue at the gym and continue, you know, working to build as much possible muscle and cut right. down as much fat as, you know, so it's kind of like you can continue in this sort of world of neurohacking as deep as you really yeah. want to or don't want to. It's all kind of a person's choice.
Right. And I suppose it's also like when the person feels ready or comfortable to take off those training wheels and start, you know, learning how to ride by themselves forever kind of thing, or at least
yeah.
for a while until it's needed again or something like that. Right. But it's amazing that in as little as 5 to 10 sessions that you can have such a significant improvement. I mean, very few things offer that kind of, you know, prognosis in terms of treatment exactly. of such heavy, you know, problems.
Exactly.
So, you know, I'm sure you're aware of binaural beats, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a form of like neurostimulation?
It's I guess a sister technology, you could right. say. And it's a legitimate technology. You can definitely influence the rhythms, the electrical rhythms of the brain by pulsing these tones into the ears. My issue though, when it comes to the binaural beats, like, you know, people always ask me about like the YouTube videos, like that they see, like, you know, it'll be like, oh, we're stimulating 332 hertz for, you know, for anxiety or emotional this or that. And it's like, you know, for one, there's no one that's actually ensuring that those videos are containing the binaural beat frequencies that are being promised. Like, you can't actually like hear
quality control.
Yeah. So it's like, are you even getting that? And then I think some of the claims that are being made, just as far as like, you know, what binaural beats can do, are kind of too far out there, which I think actually takes away from the technology in itself, because there are certain reputable companies, like such as like Centerpoint Technologies. They produce this binaural beat program called HoloSync that is very much like scientifically rooted, you know, and very effective for a lot of people. So binaural beats are kind of a mixed bag, but there's people definitely need to kind of do their research in terms of finding kind of quality binaural beats if they're going to explore that.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, you know, when you're getting YouTube versions of things, it comes with a, you know, you got to take it with a grain of salt. Know where your sources are coming from and, you know, whether you can trust them. Although I imagine there's not a huge risk other than perhaps some wasted time and disappointment. I'm not aware of any dangers associated with it, or if it goes wrong, or if they use bad frequencies. I think maybe it just won't be enjoyable, but I don't know. What do you think about that? Are there dangers to it at all?
I mean, I would assume that if people were having any severe reactions, that they would probably start like banning those videos or something. So
like seizures or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I haven't heard of any of that happening.
Yeah.
But with all of these technologies, binaural beats included, you can definitely train the brain in the wrong direction. Right. If someone's already producing plenty of beta, if they're already producing an excessive amount of beta brain waves, and they're already kind of anxious and obsessive and ruminating thoughts and all this stuff, and then you train them to produce even more beta, that's going to oftentimes like not that that's going to worsen their symptoms.
Right. So can be counterproductive.
It can be counterproductive. You can definitely push the brain in the wrong direction, which is why I think it's so important that if people are going to seek a practitioner to do neurofeedback or neurostimulation, that they make sure it's someone with a lot of experience and expertise in the field.
Yeah.
There's a couple certifications. Like I'm board certified in QEEG brain mapping, along with EEG neurofeedback. So looking for those certifications, for me, it's called a BCN is the board certification neurofeedback, and a QEEG diplomat is the board certification for the brain mapping. So looking for practitioners like with those credentials, I think, is super critical. So people make sure that, you know, who's actually training their brain knows what they're doing and isn't going to actually make things worse, which is a very real possibility if you put this technology into the hands of someone who has no clue how to use it properly.
Yeah, it would be like, you know, going to an unlicensed therapist or an unlicensed personal trainer. You're like, well, I mean, it might work, but, you know, you're trusting them to know what they're doing, which they may or may not. And there's no, you know, certification, which is sort of the standard of people being like, well, if you pass these tests, and it means you've had sufficient study and practice that people can generally trust that you do what you say you're going to do, and that there's liability in case that it doesn't, right? Some sort of liability or course for, you know, reconciliation or something like that. So yeah, that makes sense to me as well, that it's like where there's potential for good, there's potential for bad as well. If used poorly. And then, you know, the other area which is also fascinating is this emerging sort of this nootropic field, which are these like, I don't know how you quite characterize it other than like, you know, various substances or drugs to use to improve mental performance, right? That's a very interesting field, and also again comes with potential pros and potential cons, right? Like, you need to know where it's coming from and who's suggesting it, and if you're taking it properly, and you know, the treatment course is good for you. Like, there's all these areas that need to be carefully monitored in order to do it properly. But it certainly is a field that's emerging as potentially very helpful for people, right? I mean, what's your experience with that? Not personally, or personally, but I mean, just, you know, professionally at least.
So yeah, nootropics or smart drugs, as they're sometimes called, that's actually a big component of the neurohealth coaching that I offer people. We're actually, you know, helping people decide, you know, how to correctly use these things, the proper dosages, the proper, you know, timing. There's so much that goes into it, as you sort of alluded to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's so much we still don't know about kind of how some of these drugs are working. You know, there's some kind of animal data as far as like what's going on in the brain. They're usually like a true nootropic is going to be something that's actually neuroprotective. So, you know, some people might, I think, misclassify, say, something like Adderall as a nootropic because it speeds up the brain and kind of enhances various aspects of cognition. But like, it doesn't have that sort of neuroprotective. It's actually kind of neurotoxic potentially in the long term. So like a true nootropic is something that's actually going to boost brain performance and protect the brain in the long term. So when it comes to nootropics, I think the big, well, actually first backing up to like two compounds that pretty much everyone uses or knows someone who uses, which is caffeine and nicotine. Mm. So those are kind of the original nootropics, you could say. So caffeine, I'm a big fan of using it, at least in controlled dosages earlier in the day so it doesn't interrupt sleep. But they've seen that caffeine is really beneficial for a lot of different aspects of cognition. And then nicotine, if it's removed from smoking, you know, so people generally associate nicotine, obviously, like with tobacco and with cigarettes. But nicotine by itself, say in the form of like gum or patches, has actually been shown to be really beneficial for the brain. There's actually receptors in the brain called nicotinic acetylcholine receptors. So it's almost like nicotine is a perfect key that binds to those receptors and increases levels of acetylcholine, which is a really important neurotransmitter for mood, memory, focus. So,
but also those, potentially addictive, right?
Potentially, it definitely is addictive. And yeah, that's something people should definitely be wary of in terms of maybe using, if you were to experiment with nicotine, you know, not using it every day, maybe just when you have like a really long paper to write or a test to study for or something. So yeah, I do think that's an important caveat to mention. When it comes to like some of the more obscure smart drugs, like people talk a lot about like the racetams, which are kind of a class of smart drugs from Russia, I believe. And there's like the original one is piracetam. Mm. There's also aniracetam, phenylparacetam, lots of other ones, but they're all this, they all come from this family, this racetam family. And some of them work really, like one person could have a really good experience with piracetam and notice that it is really improving their cognitive performance and their verbal fluency. And then someone else could notice absolutely nothing from piracetam, but notice a really good benefit from, say, aniracetam.
Right.
For me personally, I don't really notice anything from those couple. The one that I actually use quite frequently is one called phenylparacetam, which is like 30 times stronger than piracetam. But I've personally just noticed that it noticed a clear effect. I can definitely tell when I'm on it. I can definitely see what is kind of improving with my cognitive performance. So it's very individualized. You know, it's not something where we can say like, you know, this for sure is going to work for you.
Yeah.
It's often sort of a trial and error thing. And there's, you know, certain systems, like if people like use sort of like brain training, not training, but sort of cognitive assessments, to track whether their cognition is actually being improved with the nootropics they're experimenting with.
Right.
Such as there's one called Quantified Self, like a website, and you can say take tests while you're, you know, you do a series of cognitive tests while you're not taking the nootropic, and then maybe while you're taking it and after you're taking it, so you can see exactly what's changing as far as your cognition.
Right.
If people want to like really track that.
Because it might not be sort of self-obvious exactly mm-hmm. how it's working. Like you need to know what you're trying to do.
Exactly. Yeah. And the way I've heard like some people talk about it is that they actually notice a diff, like they only notice that it was working once they come off of it. So I've heard like someone talk about, you know, they, once they stopped taking, I think it was like aniracetam, they noticed they were starting to like forget words that they had just started becoming really accustomed to remembering, and like certain like little things that their brain just wasn't quite working up to, you know, optimum capacity,
right,
that they would notice once they actually stopped taking that. So yeah, it can be very subtle sometimes.
Yeah. And I guess that's kind of, it's also kind of true of all medication and drugs, is that it affects people differently, which is sort of frustrating for most people, because it would be nice to know exactly what you're getting yourself into beforehand, but that's not the way of the world at the moment. You know, our genetics are infinitely complex and varied, and we interact differently with things. I mean, some people will take Tylenol and, you know, die, and other people will take it to, and their headache will go away, and other people will take it and nothing will happen. And it's, you know, frustrating, but it is a trial and error process. Not that, you know, we're endorsing people just recklessly try nootropics or whatever it is, because of course there's quite a lot of danger to it as well if you don't know what you're doing, and it should always be done under the guidance of some expert, whether it's a coach like yourself or a doctor or something like that. But it is a tremendously interesting field that, you know, has potential huge benefits, like the rest of the technologies that we were speaking about, right? And I'm sure the research on it is just improving and expanding, mm-hmm. and, you know, the reach will grow as the technology and the information grows with it. And, you know, who knows where we're going to be in the future with all this stuff, and how much people will be helped by it, how much people will be hurt by it. Like, it's all unknown pretty much at this point, right? We really have just started to make our way in that field, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it's still in its infancy for sure.
Yeah, as is with most of neuroscience. I mean, neuroscience has been around for a few decades, or maybe 100 years, but not a whole lot before that was of as substantially informative as it is today, right? With all the scans mm-hmm. and the various technologies and things like that. I mean, it is an exciting time to, you know, be in the field.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like every day new studies come out, say about like neurostimulation, where it's like, you know, my boss would put together a new protocol based off a research paper that may have come out last week,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that just kind of speaks to how, yeah, the field really is constantly developing and growing. And I think it's what's somewhat, you know, really exciting about neuroscience is that there's so much we don't know.
Yeah.
You know, someone who's like studying like a doctor's, you know, I forgot what it even is to be a kidney doctor, like a nephrologist or something.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, you probably know like, you know, pretty much everything. We probably know pretty much everything there is to know about like the kidneys.
Right.
But like the brain is an organ that is so complex and still so, there's so much we don't know.
Yeah.
Which makes it, yeah, really exciting to be part of neuroscience.
Yeah. And it's like orders of magnitude more complex than anything we could even conceptualize at this point. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, what fascinates me the most is just how it all comes. I mean, this is not exactly related, but it's sort of, you know, a part of it is how the whole system comes from like a single cell and from, you know, a double helix of DNA. And that makes everything. And, you know, that's insane. I mean, I get it, but not really, you know. And how that then turns into a fully functioning nervous system that's perfectly in tune with the rest of your systems and interacts with the world and learns and is self-aware and, you know, can go through all these incredible layers of consciousness. It's a totally fascinating field. And I'm glad that there's people like you working in there to figure it out, you know, so the rest of us can benefit from it.
100%, yeah.
But anyway, listen, man, thank you very much for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed this conversation. Where can people find you? Do you want to plug your stuff?
Yeah, so people can connect with me, with my company on Instagram, where Roscoe's Wetsuit Neuro. The podcast Twitter is Wetsuit Podcast. Go ahead and tweet me. And then people can check out and learn about all these technologies and find out more information about the work that I do at www.roscoeswetsuitneuro.com. So just to spell that out for listeners, that's www.roscoeswetsuitneuro.com. And also people can go to a special page if they go to roscoeswetsuitneuro.com /undergroundantics. They will find a special promo code for listeners to use if they'd like to start neurohealth coaching. And we also offer a complimentary 15-minute consultation just to see I talk with people to just inform them about kind of the coaching process. So if people are interested in that, they can go check that out.
Awesome. That's great. And I'll, of course, I'll put all those links in the description for people to check out. But yeah, I look forward to speaking with you again soon. Thanks again. Awesome. Take care.
Likewise. Take care.
Bye. Thank you.